As you probably know, it's been the task of STM people to find those clearly identified structures that you guys love so much, to find the vortex cores, see what they look like, to find the core states, find the impurity atom states, to find the step edge states, to find the grain boundaries, to find all those nanoscale objects which play such a role in describing ITC materials. And that inflicts on us somewhat of a tunnel vision. So I'm speaking for myself here, but I think there's some degree of accuracy in saying it inflicts on all of the scanned probe people. We're looking for the things you want, and we often go to very great extent to avoid all the other complicated issues which are patently obvious to us in our experiments. So I think with this in mind, Doug Scalapino asked me to give a talk not about the well-defined things that we can find, but basically about the whole environment, the electronic environment on the surface of high-TC crystals as deduced from STM. So I'm going to give the talk in two halves. So the first half is about YBCO. As you probably all know, some fraction of the canonical measurements on high-TC are done on YBCO, like neutron scattering and NMR. And then, of course, another fraction are done on BISCO. And usually one technique doesn't work on the other and vice versa, and it leaves us in a somewhat confused situation. Well, the standard lore has been that STM doesn't work on YBCO. And I'm going to explain to you today what those words mean. There's no technical difficulty with it. It's just an extremely complicated environment. So these studies of YBCO are carried out in collaboration with Alex de Lausanne, there he is, from UT Austin. And it's we exchange visits between Berkeley and Texas to try and keep this work moving forward. So here, try and focus. So there's the crystal structure of YBCO. The copper oxygen layer, okay, is sandwiched on one side by a barium oxide layer, and on the other side by a chain layer. So this is like the CO2 plane, except all these oxygen atoms are missing. And the chains run along what experimentalists call the B-axis. Now, we use cryocleaved samples, and there are basically advantages and disadvantages to that. So everything I'm telling you today is about cryocleaving. When these crystals, YBCO, are broken in cryogenic ultra-high vacuum, they break between the chain layer. So this is the chain layer here. They break between this layer and the barium oxide layer. So if they reveal the barium oxide layer, then the CuO2 plane is one unit, is, you know, 3.5 angstroms away. If they reveal the chain layer, then the barium oxide layer is between the chain layer and the CuO2 plane. So we're forced to get whatever information we can from a distance. Now, one can clearly distinguish the chain layer. It's incredibly one-dimensional from the barium oxide layer. Most of our studies have been carried out on this layer, but we do have some information about that layer. So here's the chain layer. Let's look down along the B-axis now. We have all these one-dimensional electron gases, and there's some buffer layer in between, and here's the CuO2 plane. So B points along the chains. So here's a schematic Fermi surface of the CuO2 plane, the black lines, pi zero. And then this line here, these two dots, in fact, are the Fermi points associated with the electrons in this layer. Now, how do you get such a weird image like this? Where did the one-dimensionality come from? The one-dimensionality comes from the fact that the idea of topography in STM has a hidden, it has a dark secret. Here you have the density of states of some sample, and here you have the density of states of the other electrode, the tip. This one is flat as a function of energy, and this one has some characteristic changes in it. When you bias the sample, you raise the Fermi level of the tip, so you expose all these states here for tunneling into, and you get the tunnel current. Now, provided that the shape of this spectrum is translationally invariant, then if you keep this tunnel current constant as you scan back and forth, the tip just rides up and down where the where the protrusions due to the atoms are. And you get a so-called topographic image. But that proviso is violated by all the high TCs. The spectrum is not translationally invariant. So all so-called topographies are a mixture of geometrical information about where the atoms are, and also spectroscopic information about local variations in the density of states. Please stop me and ask questions as I go along. So here's some typical topographies on three different samples of YBCO. So here's 50 angstrom squared. If you're an STM professional, you can see the copper atoms and the oxygen atoms here. We would call them well resolved. But actually, that's not what dominates. And by the way, if you take Fourier transforms, you can see them trivially. They are in this image at the correct positions. But that's not what dominates this image. What dominates is this light, dark, light, dark, light, dark. This is a oscillation in the height that the tip has to maintain to keep the tunneling current constant. And the objective of the first half hour of my talk will be to explain how this oscillation comes into being and manifests itself. So if we go out to slightly lower resolution, we see all these oscillations. Some of them are kind of in phase. There's a set of four in phase. And then there's some kind of a phase slip, and then maybe you have some more in fixed relative phase. Now you're not seeing the atoms. You're seeing these oscillations in the chains. And then if I zoom out even farther, I lose my ability to see the atoms. Now each one of these bright dashes is approximately four chains side by side, and their density of states is oscillating with a wavelength of about 14 angstroms. And then you can see it's fairly disordered. They appear and disappear. And then finally, if you zoom out to a low resolution, you find the whole crystal is full of this stuff on the CuO surface, and it basically looks like tweed, right? These lines right here are several chains that are all in phase, and there's an oscillation proceeding along the B-axis. Oh.
In that 50 angstrom picture, you have also these black spots. That's really severe damage, like oxygen atom squishing or something.
I'll show you what they are later. Okay. They're not topographic black spots. They're places where the spectrum, the integrated density of states was low for this image. So here's the kind of, this had already been discovered almost 10 years ago now by Alex de Lausanne. There are incommensurate 1D density of states modulations. Actually, this is a more recent observation made by us, that they're phase locked. They go together in four chains side by side. And then they persist for hundreds and hundreds of angstroms in phase before they peter out. So here, for example, is what the twin boundary looks like in the copper-oxygen plane. It's really, you can see that one clearly distinguishes the two different B axes just quite trivially. And you can go right in here and see the atoms on the boundary. You can see the oscillations approach the boundary and come to a halt. Now, this is Alex de Lausanne's work starting in 92. He had these topographic images of the chain surface of YBCO, and there was a lot of controversy about what they could represent. Well, we now know what they do represent. There are a series of three or four chains with a density of states oscillation, which is in phase, and then you get a break, and then you get a different phase, and so on. The world is filled with this stuff. Okay, so to measure the local density of states, which is the thing that we're contributing now, we can use DIDV mapping. If you have a certain tunnel current and then you raise the bias voltage by dV, you reveal some new states over here for tunneling. You get an additional current, dI, which is the local density of states in the sample at the energy that the tip is above the Fermi level, times dV, this current. So clearly, dIdV is proportional to the local density of states. If you measure dIdV as a function of V, you're measuring the density of states as a function of E. And you can do that at any position throughout the crystal.
Question?
Yes?
You wanted to distinguish cuprate layers from other materials.
Yes.
What did you mean by that? Because you need to take pure copper metal, some clean surface.
Yes.
The density of states will have spatial variation.
it doesn't have the characteristic space, unless there's a reconstruction.
Right.
It has some translationally invariant character, which the ITCs do not have. Like the thing you call the quasi-particle spectrum or the spectral function, it changes rapidly as a function
so
of
reconstruction. Reconstruction you will call it something similar to this.
Yeah. So now let's go do an experiment. Here's a topographic image of a YBCO surface. And we'll just walk along this line here. We'll take the DIDV spectrum at every point on that line, and we just plot them all. And it's a big mess. In fact, many of you have seen a wide variety of STM spectra taken on YBCO over the last 10 years. And the reason is not because anybody made a mistake. It's because there's an enormous variety of spectra which are available, basically anything you like. So what we see here is, the simple thing you can notice is that around 20 millivolts in the chain layer, there is a gap in the density of states. It's highly disordered, but it is there. I'll show you on the average, it's quite clear. And then inside the gap, there's a whole bunch of intergap peaks, and they're apparently at random energies and locations. We'd like to find out how that comes about.
It's optimally doped, I guess.
This is optimally doped.
6.9.
Yeah, everything I show today is optimally doped.
The green stuff is high energy.
The green stuff. Oh, that's just where the color scale changes. Probably there's some defect nearby here or something like that. So now this is the type of experiment you want to do. You can go to any point in the field of view and you write down the spectrum. So now if you do that for every point in the field of view, suppose you take 128 squared, then you'll have 15,000 spectra and then you'll be lost. So you gotta try and extract information. So now what we do is we represent the magnitude of the density of states as a color scale. Black is zero density of states. Blue is inside the gap. Green and yellow are just above the gap. And I'm sorry, green. Yellow is a high peak and red is a very high peak in the density of states. So here's a map, it's I think at 10 millivolts. You see you have all those different possibilities here. Gapped regions. Regions which don't have high peaks, but which are nonetheless have some density of states, and these extremely high peaks in the density of states, which are undergoing oscillations, as I'll show you. Okay, so now I'm going to show you those maps at a whole series of different energies, starting at 50 millivolts. So here's the same color scale. At 50 millivolts, the density of states is still clearly one-dimensional. But actually, the range of LDOS intensity is quite low. It just ranges between about here and here, between blue and green. And then as you go down 45, 40, 35, not much is happening. By the time you get down to 30, if you look carefully, you'll see that a few more black regions are appearing and that the peaks in these oscillations are getting a little bit brighter. But when we go down inside the gap, then we see a lot of action. Here's 25. The gap is here someplace. Below the gap, big regions of the field of view drop down to zero density of states at a given energy. That's 15 millivolts. As you go down in energy, more and more and more of the field of view has zero density of states. But then distributed at random, there are these things which I'm being careful not to call chains. These are not chains. They're packets of several chains in which there's a very, very vivid oscillation in the density of states, more than 200% the normal density of states.
By gap, do you mean the gap on the chains or the gap in the...
I'll come to that.
The overall gap.
Yeah, so here's, I wanted to show you some typical spectra to address that question. So here's a 16 millivolt map, here's a 0 millivolt map, and here's minus 16. So where did this oscillating peak, where did this oscillating vivid, I dare not call it a stripe either, where did this structure come from? Well, it came from this peak here in the density of states, which oscillated up and down as a function of position. But actually, there is a gap here as well. So similarly, where did this come from? It came from a big peak at zero energy, but there is a crude gap here as well. And similarly, this very vivid one here came from this peak on the other side, but also the gap is still here. They're intergap states, which are filling up all the low energy levels. Okay, so here's a funding agency photograph of this phenomenon. If you look along the B-axis, you see these oscillating spines of density of states separated more or less uniformly by regions where you have zero density of states. If you look along the A-axis, so you see the oscillations go by, you see these things. And then above the gap value, it's nowhere near as vivid. It's pretty dull contrast once you go above 20 to 25 millivolts. Now here's the average. People who do average experiments, especially ARPAs and YBCO, are dealing with this situation. If you take all those complicated spectra, you just average them together over space, you may get a spectrum which, you know, looks, typically they do look like this on our samples. So the ARPA's measurement does reach farther below the surface than the STM measurement, so it's a little bit different than this. But the intragap states, which are so common in YBCO ARPAs, are apparently associated with these guys. So here's the average, it comes down, there would have been a flat-bottomed gap here. It is at a very large number of positions, a flat-bottomed gap. But then on the average, it's filled in by all these intergap states. Yes, sir?
But ARPAs does give you momentum.
That's correct. That's correct. And there is a very clear signal in ARPAs which is can be associated with these intergap states. In fact, ZX has a paper doing exactly that right now.
What was the temperature?
Pardon?
The temperature.
This is all at 4.2 Kelvin.
So there's a notion that Sorry. There are actually sort of three distinct gap states, huh? I mean, when you look at a picture, should I take it literal or is it a matter of...
Statistically, this often happens. Okay, and I'm going to make... I mean, we often find that there are several well-defined energies at which there is a good deal of weight at the intergap density of states. And I'll comment on that a little bit later. Okay, so now we have to use the devil's tool, autocorrelation, to analyze this situation. Because there's too much disorder for us to extract some really simple things. So here, for example, is a 2 millielectron volt local density of states map. You see some of these one-dimensional oscillations, and you see a lot of dark regions. Take its autocorrelation, you get this innocent-looking picture. And we're going to be interested in the B-axis autocorrelation. If we go along this line here, we're finding out the maximum, we're finding out the order which can exist for states which point along the B-axis. So this is a graph of the B-axis autocorrelation along that red line.
Sorry, what does autocorrelation mean?
You take two functions, imagine them in one dimension. You take the same function and you convolute it with itself, with zero displacement. Then that gives the value here of the autocorrelation function. Then you displace it by one step and convolute it again. That gives the value of the next dot. And you continue. If there is spatial periodicity, the autocorrelation amplifies it very strongly. Because the next time you get to the correct period, you convolute the whole data set at the correct frequency. So the autocorrelation is designed to find spatial periodicity and structure. Okay. So the other thing we could see immediately when we started this autocorrelation is that the autocorrelation at one energy, let's say 50 millivolts, this black guy here, is extremely different than the autocorrelation at another energy, let's say the red guy. The wavelength of the oscillations is a function of energy. Basically, we're seeing dispersion in these, what I'm going to call scattering resonance states in one dimension. Any questions about that? Okay. So, by analyzing those autocorrelations for all different energies, we can now find the wavelength of those density of states oscillation as a function of energy, and it comes down like this. That would mean a dispersion relationship which goes up like this and crosses the Fermi level. Here's the intergap region. There's some more structure in here that we don't understand. But to give you a feeling of the repeatability of this phenomenon, the red and the black data set are two completely different experiments. It's really quite a good measure of what happens to the wavelength of these oscillations. Okay, so Dirk Moore and Sasha Beletsky have very recently proposed the following view of this situation. You have the planar Fermi surface. You have the Fermi points of the chains, so they're at plus and minus kF of the chains. You have coherent tunneling between the chains and the plane. And in addition, you have very strong scattering at impurities in the copper oxygen chains. I mean, that's what doping does. It takes away some of those oxygen atoms in the chains. So the proposal is that scattering from those impurities in one dimension results in pretty broad local density of states oscillations at 2 kF. And then in the normal state, you could view those oscillations as Friedel oscillations. You have one-dimensional electron gas. You have a scattering center. the quasi particles are scattering off it, and then they build up some Friedel oscillations by interference. Then when you go into the superconducting state, and here's the interesting thing, a gap opens here at the two Fermi points. The value of the gap here in the chain is proposed to be the value of the plane gap at the same value of kx. So that gap opens in the chains, and then it allows the line width for those scattering states to become very narrow.
So you're starting to show now a difference between low temperature and high temperature.
A difference between low energy and high energy, or low temperature and high temperature.
So this picture of the chain is completely gapped, is there a node in the chain?
In this picture, it's gapped at the two Fermi points.
Two Fermi lines.
Well, okay, it depends.
Either way.
So someplace a gap opens here by tunneling.
What Shannon said is that basically at the Fermi points there's always a gap. But as you go towards inside, towards the gamma point, you could come to those points along on the Fermi on the chain, where if you go vertically upward, you hit the nodes. And those points would not be gapped in the sense that you wouldn't have a delta k there. But at the Fermi points in the chains, you will always have
a it's gapped every roll on the dotted line, on the dashed line.
Yeah,
exactly. There's a correspondence between the gap here and the gap there.
But wait, if you go below the Fermi surface, it's gapped just for Fermi surface, for band structure reasons.
Right, but you cannot define, there's one point where your delta of k would actually vanish. And that is when you are at that point on the chain, when you go upwards, vertically upwards, you hit the nodes in the plane.
I'm still confused. The Fermi surface on the chain band is the dashed line, right? That's a Fermi surface.
No. The Fermi points of the chain are here and here.
Along
the dashed lines as well. Yeah.
So the model is that there's a full gap all along the dashed line.
Yes.
Yeah.
But experimentally, there's no. Experimentally, there seems to be nodes in there everywhere. Because there's no. If you look at ρS, if you look at superfluid density, there's no evidence of.
Let me keep talking, Soren. We'll come back to that point.
I still don't even understand why we think there could be gapless excitations. I mean, to take a one dimensional electron gas with a spin gap, it still has 2kF oscillations.
Well, you need to explain why, when you go below TC of the high TC superconductor, the Q of the scattering resonances goes up by an order of magnitude.
I think, I mean, look, I can't do it on my feet, but if you take the one-dimensional electron gas and open a spin gap, you reduce the number of low-energy modes, you'll probably make the structure.
But are you saying that spin gap opens at TC of the high TC superconductor? Okay, that's a possibility.
I mean, another sort of question, there's also a theory. I guess there's this rule that along the diagonal direction of the zone, the planar electrons cannot get out in the C direction, right? And then you assume that the coulombic distortion is smaller, that will shoot both here too, and I would expect actually that there is all proximity effect, that somehow you would have a gap closing on the diagonal in the polynomial curvature, is that right?
I don't actually know whether this is the correct explanation, but this is the one which is being proposed for the situation. Right. Okay. So to try and understand, some further issues about that situation, we can analyze all the, have 100 autocorrelation functions, and they're quite complicated. They have an average background, they have an amplitude, they have a decay rate, and they have a wavelength. So those parameters, that's what you should have seen.
You haven't shown this temperature dependence. You say this starts sharply at TC?
Okay, so we only do experiments at 4.2 Kelvin, but I'm going to comment on evidence that it starts sharply at TC from other techniques, okay, in about 3 slides. So you don't need to look at this. It's just a fit of that function to the autocorrelation for all the different energies from which we're going to extract the following things. We can check to see that the first parameter looks like the background density of states. This is extracted from the fit. This is the measured average density of states. It's actually very good fit. We can check for the correlation length of those oscillations. How long do they survive in space? So it's short. It's 40 or 50 angstroms above the gap energy. As you approach the gap energy, it gets a little peak in it. And then inside the gap, it has some oscillations. At the Fermi level, their decay length is about 120 angstroms, so they actually survive on both sides for up to 500 angstroms. They're an extremely large state. The intensity of those oscillations, and this is the point, the intensity of the oscillations, the gap opens here and approximately here. Outside the gap, the amplitude of the local density of state oscillations is very low, but inside the gap, it goes up by more than an order of magnitude. Something is allowing those states to have a much, much smaller gamma when you're inside the high TC gap. Okay, now, there's a recent NQR paper, which is where the NQR is specific to the coppers in the chains, and it shows a very large line broadening, which opens immediately as the temperature falls below TC, right here. So this has been interpreted to mean that in bulk, the states in these chains, the amplitude of the density of states oscillations can rise almost immediately when the temperature goes below TC, which is consistent with what's observed at the surface in terms of energy. Whoops, bad photocopy. Okay, so there's a paper by Basov where he shows that the B-axis penetration depth is significantly shorter than the A-axis, so there is superfluid density in the chains. That's the statement from the spectroscopy people.
Influencing
what's happening in the planes. I mean, that's a tricky. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
One of the co-authors
who disagree with. Who shall not be identified? Okay, so here's another paper. This is by Hovmook, where they show in bulk that there are 16 angstrom, approximately, charge density oscillations in the bulk of the sample.
In the plane.
Oriented with the B axis where the chains are pointing.
Right.
Okay, and I don't have the preprint with me, but there's a paper by ZX that shows if you point the Oppis in the B-axis, there's a vivid intergap state which is observed by Oppis. So I would claim this is actually a three-dimensional situation. The one-dimensional electron gas in the chains undergoes some change as you go through TC. The issue is, you know, does it cause something or is it just responding to something? And of course, we don't know the answer to that. So here's the conclusions. There are very strong resonances. We don't actually identify the impurities, although we're working on that right now. The proposal is its proximity superfluidity in the chains, that there's a gap, and that below the gap energy, you get these very intense oscillations in the local density of states.
But let me just make sure, the oscillations are at the 2kF, the expected 2kF of the chains.
They are at the Fermi level, but you saw the dispersion, so if I go away from the Fermi level, I can see them at all other energies as well. Okay, so here's an outstanding question. These packets are 3 to 4 unit cells wide. They're not one chain. We can analyze that situation with autocorrelation as well. We use a Lorentzian to measure the width of one of those packets. And the only thing you need to look at here is this scale. This is 2 unit cells wide, 2.5, 3 unit cells wide, and so on. Outside the energy gap, they're about 2 unit cells wide. As you go into the Fermi level, there's a big peak in the width of those states. So at the Fermi level, it's almost 4 unit cells wide. And this persists for many different optimally doped samples and just a wide variety of situations. So do those chain states influence the copper-oxygen plane or vice versa? Well, of course, we don't know. But here's one thing I would say. If these phenomena are in bulk, then there are nanometer length scale local variations in the charge density. And every copper oxygen plane is sandwiched between two more or less incoherent versions of that structure. So the chemical potential in the copper oxygen plane is probably undergoing some quite significant perturbations. I would be willing to bet that there are some correlations between this phenomena and the structure of the spectral function in the plane. Okay, that's all I got to say about YBCO. Any other questions?
You promised us that you would look, sometimes look at the barium outside.
The days are short, you know. yeah, it's on the agenda. So by the way, let me just say again that...
did you see anything striking, I guess?
We know it doesn't have the trivial D-wave spectrum, which is either expected from simple theory or is found on the bismuth surface of YBCO. It has a much more complicated spectrum, which varies spatially. But we don't have enough data to do this type of analysis yet.
Sorry, what does that mean? That means it doesn't have the V-shaped density?
Yeah, it has a spectrum approximately. Well, look, I tried to tell you that high TC spectra, one example of them, hardly mean anything. And here I am, I'm going to draw a spectrum. But let's say, and typical is a dangerous word, so let's say a common spectrum. Looks like where these energies here are in the 10 millivolt range, but they vary a lot as a function of position, and they don't fit like a S-wave BCS or anything. Too soon to say. Okay, now I want to talk about BISCO. Pardon?
Florida is still out.
Yeah, Florida is still out. OK, so in BISCO, we do have the ability to get a spectrum which we believe is associated with the high TC superconductor. So this work now is done in collaboration with Uchida in Tokyo and my group in Berkeley. So here's the BISCO unit cell, and it cleaves right here between the bismuth oxide and the bismuth oxide layer, and it reveals BIO. And we see the bismuth atoms in the topographic images. They look like this. So here's the y-axis, theorist's y-axis. Here's the theorist's x-axis. Here's the experimentalist B and A. So one plaquette is right there. There should be a copper-oxygen plaquette exactly registered underneath. Now, in addition, you have this supermodulation. It's a static distortion of the surface with wavelength 22 angstroms. And it does influence the superconductivity we're now learning. And then finally, you have what appear to be different reconstructions along these lines of maximum stress in the supermodulation. One possibility is that the dopant atoms are in here someplace. But oxygen doesn't hybridize at the Fermi level, so it's very hard to image it at low voltages. So we're not sure where the oxygen atoms are. So here's a bigger field of view. So there's a supermodulation maximum. There's the bismuth oxide lattice. You see it quite clearly. You see these strange reconstructions on the surface. And then in addition, you see these bright and dark regions distributed at random throughout the sample. And eventually, we've come to learn that these are not a technique problem or a stability problem or an STM problem or anything. They're a property of this surface of BISCO. OK, I showed you this already. You can measure the local density of states by measuring the IDV as a function of V. So you would expect in a simple D-wave model to get this spectrum. Of course, you have to take into account the fact that if this was your dx squared minus y squared model, you have two intervening layers before you come to the tip. Conventional wisdom is that the symmetry of the interlayer matrix element is like the symmetry of the gap, so that one preferentially captures electrons from these points. I'm actually a little bit skeptical about that in the STM situation. Not all the observations are consistent with that statement. But that's what conventional wisdom is. So here's a common spectrum on the bismuth oxide surface. It's got the coherence peaks. The gap value here is about 45 millivolts. So this is 90 between here and here. And it's got this peak dip hump signature, which is also seen in ARPAs. And it's got it on both sides. It also has always, now we know for millions of spectra, that the density of states falls with rising energy.
Wouldn't an S-shape look more
likely? Yes, an S-shape is quite likely. I was just saying that we know that it falls. We're very confident of that. So that spectrum has a huge amount of nanoscale inhomogeneity. So to show that situation, I'm going to do the same thing again. Here's a topographic image of a piece of BISCO. There's about 20 impurity atoms in here, and you can't see them on this surface. You'll see them later. Again, the density of state scale will be from black is low, blue is inside the gap, blue-green here is just outside the gap, yellow is in the coherence peaks, and red is up here. And now we can take this spectrum at every single position in the field of view. And now to show you that data set, again, what I'm going to do is, I'll show you a map of the density of states at some energy for this whole field of view. This is the map for minus 100 millivolts. And then I'm going to march through the energies, and you'll see the distribution of the density of states as a function of energy. So 94, we're going down here now. It's fairly homogeneous until we start to go down inside the dip. Below 70, we see the inhomogeneity turn on. Now we start to go up in the coherence peaks. Still a lot of vivid inhomogeneity. Go over the top, come down inside. Inhomogeneity disappears here someplace. It becomes uniform. All the way down here, it's a uniform, good superconductor. At the bottom, you see the impurity atoms. And then you see the reverse of this process as you exit on the other side. You go into the coherence peaks, and you get all this vivid nanoscale variation in their values. You exit on the other side. By the time you get out beyond the dip, it'll have become homogeneous again. Now, a couple of points to make about this. We now know that signals like this persist on a clearly identified area of the surface for periods of at least 3 months. This is a perfectly static property of this surface. Okay? So the other question you might say is, okay, this is a particularly bad sample. Uchida really screwed up, and it's full of junk. We know that that's false as well. So here's a more conventional way of looking at the data. Here's topography. Here's the DIDV map at minus 54. Here's the DIDV map at minus 30. Here's at minus 24. And here's at the Fermi level, you can see the impurity atoms. Now, a completely different sample made by a different fabricator in Japan and measured by a different operator in my lab 18 months later looks like this. This is an intrinsic property of this surface. See the inhomogeneity turn on here? It's vivid at the coherence peaks. It disappears at low energies. You see the few impurity atoms at the Fermi level. Now, that's a lot of data. So there are several different ways I can show it to you. So one way is we can sort 15,000 spectra from one of those experiments. By the way, that movie I showed you took 48 hours to acquire. So we can sort the 15,000 spectra. And let's just sort them according to gap magnitude. And I use these guys advisedly. The definition of gap is half the distance between the first maximum on one side and the first maximum on the other side. So if we sort them from those two experiments, we find they're in reasonably good agreement. About 2% of the spectra have gap 25 millivolts. 11 have 30 millivolts. 26 have 35. You get the idea. There's a distribution of the available gap values, and it spans the range from 25 to about 65. These two guys here are probably due to the zinc impurity atoms, as is this thing here. And again, the nickel data set, which was the other data set, it's in very good agreement. There are characteristic changes in the shape of the spectra, but the statistical distribution is reasonably repeatable from sample to sample. Now, there's another thing we can do. We can just travel along a particular line and write down the spectrum at each point. And as you can see, it's a mess. And that would be true for any line you would choose. It's a mess everywhere. Nonetheless, at any given point in the field of view, one can measure the distance between these two peaks and divide by two. So one can plot the so-called gap magnitude as a function of position. And we call that a gap map. I think I should have patented this name, but it's a little bit too late. So the gap map looks like this for those two experiments. Here's the distribution of gap values. Here's the distribution of gap values for the other sample. The mean values were different by about 5 millivolts. I presume because the oxygen doping was slightly different in both cases, but I can't prove that. You can see the gaps varying from 30 in here, 30 to 55. And you can see that they are actually spatially arranged in some very interesting fashion. Some little packets of high gap, and then other regions of low gap. And then you can see, you know, at least to attest to the degree of disorder and the patch size of the disorder, these guys are equivalent. Now, these variations in the gap map are not due to the impurity atoms in this sample. When I first made this slide, that was a guess, but we now know that that's true, because we've been doing experiments with no impurity atoms. We get exactly the same phenomenon. So put aside your caveats about the impact of the 20 impurity atoms in this sample here. At least the deliberately doped zinc and nickel impurity atoms do not create this situation. So here's a summary. 2212, TC is 85 Kelvin, but that's due to suppression by the impurities. They're clean, cryocleaved bismuth oxide surfaces. They have inhomogeneity in DIDV at the nanoscale. The gap magnitude varies from 20 to 65. They have characteristic spectra associated with each delta. The patch size is a few nanometers. The Fermi level density of states is very low and uniform. It's actually amazing how low and uniform it is, despite all the huge variations at high energy. The inhomogeneity is not due to the impurity atoms. There are some correlations between the gap map and the topography. The simplest one is that there is a variation in the gap associated with the supermodulation, but it's like a second order effect. And now this has been observed in many different crystals and within the last 6 months by several different labs. Okay, so the rest of my talk now is purely speculation, for which I do not want to be held personally responsible. But I'd like to give you some ideas about this situation. So here's some possibilities we came up with. It's important to note, of course, that this is at a particular surface. I just spent half an hour proving to you that another surface of another crystal is pathological. So I can't claim now that this surface is not pathological. It could easily be. But there are several possibilities. It could be a surface phenomenon only. We still have to reconsider other surface probes of BISCO, what they tell us about high TC. It could be a bulk phenomenon, and it could be a universal phenomenon.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
All the data you showed was with impurities, though, this inhomogeneous gap. Both those sets of data...
They had impurities, but we get the same result with no impurities. No substitutional impurities at the copper site, to be precise.
I guess you've got all different things to rely on, oxygen,
We're working on it. Yeah. So let's consider this issue first. If it's only a surface phenomenon, as you all know only too well, the ARPES data, upon which a lot of the foundations of the field are built, are taken on the surface that I just showed you, which is prepared in exactly the same fashion. It's cryocleaved. Oh, and I should make a very important caveat. What I'm reporting now is in contradiction to what was reported by Oyston Fisher 5 or 6 years ago. Here they show uniform spectra as a function of position for distances up to 340 angstroms. You know, one reason why we struggle trying to understand our surfaces so much is because of this result. But really, we've given up. I don't know how this result was achieved. Maybe it was a different cleavage scheme, annealing scheme, tip scheme. I really don't know. But this is in contradiction to what I just told you. Pardon me?
It agrees with your average spectrum.
Oh, it agrees very well with the average, yeah.
Is there spatial resolution comfortable?
There's no spatial data in these papers. There's no resolution data in these papers. You can write down a number saying how wide your tip moved, but that's like saying I have a bus and I moved it 1 micron. Okay? The resolution is not determined by how far you moved the tip.
They have a bus involved. Yeah. Explain this data.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever. I mean, a fat tip can do it, but there's no explicit demonstration either way. Was there another question?
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, you presumably asked it.
They use a different preparation recipe. The crystals were cleaved at room temperature in helium and then inserted into the cryostat. So that's different. And then the resolution either... The resolution information is unavailable.
Have you offered to share one of your crystals with them so you could read?
They have access to the same crystals we do.
But in what way are they contradictory? Because if they don't have the resolution, then they are just measuring an average gap, and it agrees with
that's
them.
Quite correct. In that sense, they may not be contradictory. It's just that this makes it appear as if the spectra do not vary from location to location.
Okay.
Okay, now, 5 years ago, Ed Wolf wrote what, if you read it, you'll see it was a Fizrev letter that was rejected. And he reported that there are gap magnitude variations on the bismuth oxide surface of BISCO that span the range between 25 and 55 millivolts, and that the patch size is 5 nanometers. In the last 6 months, this has been seen by Nishida in Tokyo, and I saw last week by Matsuda in NTT, and mapped as a function of doping. The STM people now are coming to believe that this is a real property of this surface. Okay, so the implication for ARPAs. So here's a histogram of gap values for a 500 angstrom square region. Now, if you averaged all the DIDV spectra for the same region for those two experiments I showed you, they give these very innocent looking tunneling spectra for the surface. They look very like planar tunneling results. They're broad, they're fairly low. But otherwise, the numbers are in good agreement with the average. So here's an ARPA spectrum from ZX's group. This is slightly underdoped, 2212 in the pi zero direction. And I just want you to look at this low temperature spectrum here. I'm going to overlay our average spectra on it with no manipulation. I just match the energy scales, and I match the peak heights here. So I don't claim that this is a quantitative comparison between the two different techniques to study this material, because the function which relates what the ARPA's data represents and what the STM data represents is at present unknown. However, it seems pretty clear that the line width here, which is about 35 millielectron volts, does not represent the quasiparticle of BISCO at 4 Kelvin. Our typical line widths for good spectra are 6 or 7 millivolts. So this line width is a statistical property, in my opinion, of averaging over a wide variety of different nanoscale patches. So here's the implication for ARPAs. If the samples are prepared in the same fashion, and if the ARPAs is sensitive to the same layer, then 2212 ARPAs represents an average over nanoscale regions where the quasiparticle spectrum varies. And energy axis parameters, specifically peak dip hump and the lifetime, they do not represent unique properties either of the interaction or of the quasiparticles. You can imagine that this message is not very popular. So here's another possibility. This is a bulk phenomenon. This is a real phenomenon of BISCO. There's another type of impurity atom in BISCO. The dopant atoms are non-stoichiometric. They have to go in between the layers at some fairly random location. They capture two electrons, so they're highly charged, and the screening length is much bigger than the distance between the layers. So you have these sources of electrostatic charge distributed around at random. So one possibility is that variations in the oxygen doping density generate this inhomogeneity. Here's a gap map between 20 and 60 millivolts. So variations in the oxygen doping that we can't see a priori generate this situation. That would mean that there are nanoscale regions where the gap values span all possible parts of the phase diagram. And it's kind of an attractive idea at first blush, but it doesn't capture one of the other major things which is known about high TC, which is that there's a gap above TC. You got to account for this situation. So here's the original beautiful work of Renner and Fisher on that subject. Here's TC right here. And then above TC, there's a very clear gap. This now has been reproduced in a variety of different situations. So single particle tunneling gap does exist above TC. It's also known that there's strong indication for two independent gaps. So the most recent one of these is by Krasnov at Chalmers. At low temperatures, there are these high peaks. This is SIS tunneling, so it doesn't look like our spectra, but that's only because it's a convolution. As you go up in temperature, you see one peak and another peak. As you go through TC, you see one peak and a second peak. And then above TC, one peak survives. This is the pseudo gap. This is the superconducting peak. Or at least that's the claim of the people who work on this subject.
Could it be that it's a hump in your... That the second peak is what you call hump in your spectrum?
No, it's too low in energy. The hump is way out, like 120 millivolts. So let's take the two ideas I just brought up, pseudo gap and two spectra. So what would be a logical explanation? Well, a logical explanation is that there are simultaneously two different phases. The pseudo gap phase is one of them, and the superconducting phase is the other one. Now, there's a lot of candidates for those phases. Could be stripes, could be staggered flux phase, it could be the hidden order d-density wave phase, it could be some other unknown phase, let's say some antiferromagnetic fluctuation phase that hasn't been identified. But two phases, simultaneously present, with nanosegregation between the phases.
You have to talk about the statistics of the gap map. In some sense, it's clearly not just a random map. There's some ordering in that.
You mean these statistics?
No, the spatial statistics.
Oh, yeah. It's not. There are characteristic patch sizes, and there are characteristic regions between them. And those issues are being explored right now. So another possibility, consistent with the observations, is that there are two different electronic phases. You can't distinguish them trivially by looking at their spectra, because the pseudo-gap spectrum delta varies continuously with X, and the superconducting spectrum varies continuously with X. So no particular value of X favors one over the other. Plus, this is optimal doped. So probably, if it were nanosegregated, it's dominated by a single phase. So I thought, since most people have their own phase diagram for ITC, I thought maybe the STM guys could have their phase diagram as well. So consistent with the hidden order view of the situation, and also the work on the pseudo gap by Talon and Lorem, I think, I hesitate to say that we propose this, but let's say, for the purposes of discussion, this could be the phase diagram. This line represents the point where the second phase here stops existing. So either the staggered flux phase, or hidden order phase, pseudo gap phase, whatever you like to call it. I call it D-wave phase 2. So this line represents where it's beyond this line, it doesn't exist. So up here, it's more or less homogeneous. Down here, it's nano-segregated between high TC and D-wave. And over here, you have homogeneous high TC. So within the context of the very small amount of information we have available, this is still consistent. We're doing our very best to rule it out.
So you haven't looked at overdoped samples?
We've looked at underdoped, and it's too soon to make a conclusion.
At overdoped?
We haven't looked at overdoped yet.
A histogram looks more like a Gaussian than like a superposition of two different.
Okay, that's an excellent question. The histogram has a fault in it. Approximately 8% of the field of view, the spectra, have four peaks in them. This fact is screwing up the histogramming scheme, because the histogram just finds one or the other of them. It doesn't have a tool to represent both. So on those in the range of 8% of the sample has that spectrum. We believe that it's associated with the transition from one domain to another, for obvious reasons. Yeah?
I think the trouble with this, with invoking the staggered flux or the d-density wave, is that that has a finite density of state of permeability. Since you have a very, that's the one thing that is clear in the data, that your density is very zero.
But don't forget that we work down here. We at present don't have the technical ability to go above this line. Mm-hmm. So possibly if we were working up here, we would distinguish the two phases according to which one had a zero density of states and which one didn't.
No, it's the opposite. Down there, you should be just as mixed as you are up there. I mean, you're saying you're mixed.
Yeah.
That's the proposal.
You have non-zero density of states in one phase.
Yeah. Is it obvious you get some proximity effect coupling, which might open a gap?
Well, proximity effect doesn't open a gap.
No, it only makes gap every.
Well, let me comment. There's nowhere in the field of view where the density of states is explicitly zero. The minimum is 3% of the normal density of states. And that's always been the case for BSCO. Any other? A conclusive experiment would be to either cross this line with nanoscale resolution or to cross this line and then that line. Present, we don't have the technology to do that.
Conclusive would be transport measurements.
Well, let me comment on some transport measurements. You know, above here, there's a Nernst effect, and there's also Yeah. So the additional proposal would be that above this line, there are still some incoherent droplets of the superconducting state.
That's always there.
What is the highest temperature you can go to now?
25 Kelvin. So maybe a low TC sample, we could do it. Any other questions?
They don't really, you know, theorists don't really have any problems with U-wave 2. The problems they have with that paper is that it's not motivated by the presence of the insulator on the left.
I think I agree with that. It's just that, okay.
There's a simple model. You can just have, you know, fluctuation in the doping concentration or local.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you need to invoke that in a separate phase?
I think it would be difficult.
Because you need to have the pseudo gap phase above TC.
Well, there's no problem. I mean, the pseudo gap phase isn't really, it's just the normal state above TC.
Yeah.
Okay, you need to have the normal state above TC, so that's two states.
I mean, in this optimal P-dope sample, the pseudo gap lives in the.
It's pretty small. Yeah, that's correct.
So it can be consistent with this.
Yeah, that's probably correct. I think it'll take more data over here,
yeah,
down here, to find out whether or not this is a realistic proposal. That's correct. Yeah?
In that inhomogeneous state, what was the main difference between the spectra in the blue and the black region? They both showed gaps, superconducting gaps.
So most of the black regions here, the high energy spectra, out here, are associated with the darker regions. Most of the bright regions are associated with the low energy spectra over here.
So it's just they're both superconducting, but the gaps are different, is that it?
What I've been trying to say is that STM doesn't have the ability to distinguish between two different gapped sets of spectra, calling one superconducting and the other not. We don't know. Yes?
I don't know if this is possible, but if we integrate the density of states over the occupied states, we get the density of electrons. And now you showed us that at high energy, the spectra all look the same. So presumably you could get some opinion of the variation of electron density as you move across the sample.
It's in very good agreement with this picture. The low integral of that number is the dark areas.
Low integral, that's low number of electrons or low number of doped holes.
Well, I guess it's the low number of doped holes, but I'd have to think about it.
That's what Patrick is saying, right? Right. That you see the hole density, will therefore it varies to maybe due to oxygen. Whatever.
Yeah, it's too soon to say.
But if the hole density is really low in your black regions, you know, that's where the gap is quite large.
Yeah, that's a very large gap region.
Yeah.
That's what I'd call the pseudo gap phase. Yes.
So is it fair to say that the size of the gap correlates with the width of coherence peaks?
No, it's not. It looks like you have both classes of spectral shapes. So here's the phase diagram, let's say. So imagine that there's a delta star associated with that line. Mm-hmm. And there's a delta associated with some other line. Then at any given value of x, you can get both spectra.
No, I mean, as a function of space. Do you find that where gap size is small, the peaks are generally sharp, and
yes.
vice versa.
Yes. Yes, correct? That's one of the clearest observables.
Okay.
James, in the density of states that you just erased where you have four peaks, what is the energy scale of the peaks?
The lower one might be 25 millivolt peak, and the upper one might be 40 or 50 millivolt peak.
Do you see, you say you see those occasionally? You see, occasionally you see four peaks? Or?
Not occasionally, you know, between 8 and 10% of the time. But they are associated. We haven't really been able to distinguish precisely what they're associated with, but they're somehow associated with transitions from one region to another, as you would expect. I mean, even if it was just random inhomogeneity, you would expect that situation.
I'm only if you're aware that the NMR people are sort of doing similar stories, that possibly Schlichter and especially my.
Yeah, I'm very well aware of it. It happens that right now there's a very large amount of information coming out from a variety of different probes that indicates that the superconducting state is inhomogeneous on the nanoscale. Terahertz, NMR, μSR, neutron scattering, heat capacity. The heat capacity data for BISCO is really extremely blunt and broad in its energy scales on the underdoped side. That's been a mystery for a long time. But if it's an inhomogeneous mixture, that's no problem. Okay, so one thing which is really bad with this proposal is that Fuanong says that the mean free path of your YBCO is 2 microns, and that that's not consistent with having nanoscale inhomogeneity.
But didn't you say that low energy density of states is very homogeneous?
They're highly homogeneous. It's actually amazing. They're indistinguishable from each other below about 15 millivolts.
But isn't that all right?
Yeah, then that's all right, because these low energy quasi-particles presumably contribute to transport. No.
Well, then you have to understand why that is.
These quasi-particles are in sharp nodes.
Yeah.
They're in sharp, angularly sharp nodes. No question of that, because of the magnetothermal resistance.
You're mainly seeing the zero high. Your spectroscopy is mainly seeing zero high.
Still, the question is why don't, if you've got these big charge inhomogeneities, especially if you're looking at forward scattering and thermal transport, why don't they scatter off of it? I mean, they don't. It's a fact. But it's not a trivial counterintuitive.
Many of the STM observables are not consistent with the spectra, only capturing the signal from pi zero. There are spatial structures at impurity atoms, and the overall shape of the spectrum is consistent with some unknown average. Yeah. It's consistent with some unknown average around K-space, but it's not consistent with preferentially coming from pi zero.
What if you have a fallacy autocorrelation function for this? Yeah, gestation.
It's about a 5 nanometer, almost circular patch size with a dip for an exclusion region.
Seamus, you said below 15 MeV, the density of states basically looks the same everywhere. So does it imply that the slope is the same everywhere?
I'll show you the data. So the low energy spectra here.
Have you ever put them on top of each other?
Yeah, they're within the noise. They're almost indistinguishable from each other. That's not true over here, but this is because there's a little additional density of states here due to the zinc scatterers in this sample. Yeah?
If you were seeing just a mixture of two phases, then why was your gap distribution, why was it not bimodal? That's what I would have expected.
That's an excellent question, and I don't know the answer. That's a good reason to reject what I have proposed. We're trying to analyze the situation. So one thing which is true is that the idea of finding the first two peaks and dividing the distance between them by two and writing down the answer is not sufficient to properly represent the sophistication of what's going on. So the gap histogram has a lot of problems with it. and we're trying to develop the appropriate, to ask the correct question to segment the different regions if they exist.